Hello, everybody, and welcome to Awakenings. Awakenings is a podcast that invites us all to share a wider story of the human family. We're delighted to be in conversation with leading systems thinkers as we ask ourselves this question as leaders, as people, how do we navigate a crisis of such magnitude that it threatens our existence? What will our legacy be for our human family? We'll be looking at the roots, really, of how we ended up here, in the context of how we use that learning, this wider story, to help us shape a brighter future, to change the choices that we make for the world that we want to have. I'd very much like to acknowledge our elders, our ancestors, the people who in some ways suffered greatly. But if we can learn from their experiences, we can transform that into something that will light us really forward to a much brighter path. I'd also really like to recognise Foundation Nova Diem for their huge generosity in making this podcast possible. Thank you to all of you, and thank you for listening. Good morning, afternoon, evening, everyone. It's a delight to be here on our final episode of Awakenings. This episode looks at neocolonialism and how we can move from extraction to inclusion. And we're absolutely delighted to have on today's show Caroline Mayer Toby, who's an international lawyer and director and founder of the Small Institute for Small Islands. Caroline has an international lawyer with over 15 years of experience in research, working with public, private and civil society stakeholders. She specializes in climate change, in climate diplomacy, climate justice, public international environment and business and human rights law. She has 20 years research experience on the Caribbean, African, Indian subcontinent and Pacific Island colonialism, empire and post-colonial relations. And she works extensively with Indigenous and Indigenous Maroon people and on their rights in climate and environmental justice and biodiversity issues. And she's published and spoken widely on these matters, and we're absolutely delighted to have her for this episode of the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today, Caroline.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
That's wonderful. So, Caroline, I know we're going to have I'm really excited to hear from you about your work and how it feeds into our subject today of neo-colonization. But I think you might have a couple of questions for me before we start.
Yes, I'm so excited to be here, Cindy. Honestly, this is, I was just saying before, you know, this is a conversation that's been building for a couple of years now with us. So, yeah, I mean, I think it would be really helpful as a background if we can get your perspective, you know, maybe if you can kind of give me a broad background, a broad brush background to the impact of colonialism, post-colonial geopolitics, accepting, you know, of course it is multidimensional and it's impossible to explain in just a soundbite. Can we get into that? Or is there anything you want to get into before?
No, that would be great, Caroline, because I really want to spend time talking about your incredible work. So we've talked quite a lot about colonization itself in this series. You know, we know that it's a 500-year history. You know, really, in essence, colonization was a mechanic to extract from the countries that were colonized. You know, this has involved, you know, huge resource extraction, which has created massive environmental impact, as well as underdevelopment and oppression. And and as we've talked about in some of the other episodes, you know, genocides, massacres, huge decimation of people. And when the thing is that people think that when colonialism ends, which people tend to think is after World War II, that things change. But what we actually shift into is an updated system of that old order. Things don't really change that much. Post-colonial geopolitics are based on continuing control of resources and an ideology that supports that happening. And in the consequence of, so in colonial countries that have been colonized, you now have puppet leaders put in, and who are incredibly corrupt. And in its own way, this leads to the same kind of extraction and underdevelopment that we've had from that 500-year colonial history. An example for that would be the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where Patrice Lumumba, he was a rising star of the young generation of a much more socially minded type of government. But you know, the post-colonial order will have, having none of this between Belgium and the CIA, he was taken out and a puppet was put in place. And in this case, that the ghastly Mobutu, who reigned from 1967, I think, till the mid 90s. And, you know, he himself, when he died, had a personal fortune of over $5 billion, because that was his kickback, if you like, for facilitating access to the continued access to the resources of the Congo. That's just one, you know, one example. In my father's country, Guyana, as you know, I'm from Guyanese heritage. We had Forbes Burnham. We had, you know, a fantastic, there was an uprising of a really brilliantly socially minded government. But again, the CIA and the British squashed that and they put their puppet Burnham in, who died the fifth richest black man in the world, but leaving Guyana a really impoverished backwater. There was a remarkable Guyanese scholar and activist, Dr. Walter Rodney, who raised serious opposition to Burnham, and he was assassinated in 1980. So, you know, that pattern just continued of putting in the people who would give them access to resources, taking out the people who put up any resistance. And this really, you know, that meant that the extraction continued. Some of the other colonial states just kind of went down the track that had been laid for them by the colonial powers. And so the ecological destruction continues, the displacement of indigenous people under the banner of development. Thousands of communities were evicted in the same way that they were during the colonial era. In India, for example, I think it's around 24 million Adivasi people, indigenous people, were displaced for development projects. I think you'll know much more about than me that what happened in Brazil. You know, you've got the military and the non-military governments coming in, triggering wholesale destruction, huge areas of the Amazon rainforest. And then the indigenous people are pushed to the margins of their own land, suffering horrible rates of extermination and murder. It just goes, those are just a couple of examples. I think I've probably made the point. So the frontiers of ecological destruction are constantly expanding, with the global economy's appetite for new materials growing. So you still have this pattern repeating itself. I mean, you'll know more about what's going on in the Amazon than I do. A fifth of Peru has been conceded to mining companies. So it's just the same order, but in a different package. And I think that's something that's really important for us to recognize, because people seem to think that colonialism finished with the Second World War, with, you know, so-called independence of many of these countries. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I smiled when you said that, because it was a wry laugh, because, you know, that's what we think. But we do, little did we realize that it just went out of view. It just went around the corner. But so why, my question to you is, you know, why does making this visible matter to you? You know, from the personal to the systemic level, why do we need to see and confront the history of colonization, when there are a lot of people who are very, very happy to, you know, just brush it under the carpet, get on with it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think it's absolutely critical that we do, not in a way to pass guilt and blame, but to really take I think Ben Okri says, you know, we can only create a future from the depth of the truth that we face now. And as a human family, we're facing this existential crisis that threatens our own ability to, you know, to exist here. And if we don't really understand how we got to that point, we can't find realistic and the deep systemic solutions that we need to get out. But for much of our history as a human family, we did manage to live in balance with nature. Some peoples were better at it than others. It's only in the last, you know, this last 97%, really, at the 3% of our time, our short 300,000 year stay on this planet, that we've adopted this model. So it's not something that we have to do. It's something that's been almost inculcated into our brains, that this growth at any cost, this neoliberalism, this rampant, hugely destructive capitalism is the only system that we have. So by understanding, making visible not only the history of the colonization, but the fact that it's still going on, really gives us an opportunity to see what we can correct, really, and how we can get ourselves out of this mess. You know, at the moment, we have this new scramble for Africa's resources. They're being plundered for the green revolution. Africa is the most mineral-rich continent, is home to raw materials necessary for the solar panels, efficient, you know, what we think, you know, the solar panel, the electric batteries. And so we've got the West now moving in to take control of these resources because Africa's too economically fragile. There's just this terrible global imbalance of power, which means, you know, that this can continue happening. So yet again, the West will develop from extracting resources from Africa, is profiting hugely from extracting resources from Africa, and Africa benefits very little. You know, we see that in South America, the indigenous lands, the mining, the demand for resources, whether it's minerals, whether it's land for cattle, whether it's palm oil, you know, that's just the indigenous people are being pushed further and further and further, you know, to their last frontiers. The work that was begun by Columbus and Cortez carries on. So I think it's incredible, and there's, you know, hundreds of other examples that we could use, but it's incredibly important for us to recognize this pattern and call it for what it is. You know, take a good, hard look at ourselves, as I say, as a human family, and just say, do we want to carry on in a spiral that's really eating up everything? When the First Nations people understood what the settlers were doing, you know, they were absolutely horrified. They said, this is wetiko. This is an illness almost of extreme greed and consumption that's highly contagious. It affects almost everybody that comes into contact with it. They knew that it would destroy their world, and their prediction, if you like, it would take everybody's world. And that is almost what we're seeing, pretty much what we're seeing now. And to recognize the pattern means that we can stop and reset and do something about it. Whereas if we continue to live in denial, we don't have that opportunity.
You know, that's the thing. We need to have the opportunity. You know, we are rapidly getting rid of that little narrow window of opportunity to even have the opportunity. It's like two loopholes to get through. But one more question. So as somebody passionate about earth-led education, to change our relationship to nature, to earth, to our future, you know, what are the entanglements between colonization, neocolonialism, and climate change efforts? How would you paint that picture?
Well, I think that's a really important question, Caroline, because things are so intermeshed, and it does go back to, you know, to recognizing this pattern. Because the extraction continues today. The economic colonization is accelerating in Africa again, with alongside the West, countries such as South Korea, Saudi Arabia, China are buying land and assets from these already impoverished countries well below their worth. And in fact, the income gap between the global north and the south is now four times larger today than it was at the end of colonization. So we're just perpetuating this cycle of huge resource extraction and underdevelopment. And if we have countries that are in that condition, there's no way that we can actually find the solutions that we're going to need. None of those countries can respond adequately to climate mitigation, to adaptation. You know, it's just, we must draw those links and find a way to stop this depletion of one part of the planet for the enrichment of another and a very small portion of the other. It's so inequitable, and it prevents any real holistic attempts to solve the climate crisis. And it is happening in so many ways. And if you look at the moment with chocolate in England here, there was a big outcry because Easter eggs had become so expensive. So, you know, people are seeing this thing Easter, but why? You know, if you actually unpick why that's happening, it's a link between the climate crisis and the exploitation of people. Because what's happening here is the because the climate crisis is affecting the farmers so much, they have to change the way that they're, you know, they have to put more investment in their land to protect the crops and the plants. But because they're being paid at such an exploitative rate, they can't respond by doing that. So then the harvest fails. The people on the ground become poorer. The people in the West are upset because their chocolate costs more. And it's really because you've got a few small number of massive cocoa producing companies who've got away with not paying the farmers a living income for such a long time, despite the huge increased demand for chocolate. So it's kind of cycling through everything, and to make these things visible by better education, by this understanding our planet more systemically, is really critical. Otherwise, you just get people and best go, why is chocolate so expensive, when it's really linked to the climate crisis and to the exploitation, which are all products of of this colonial pattern. I mean, I was going to go on and give more incidents of what's happening in Ecuador, in South America, in Brazil. I just don't think I will do that, though, because I know that that's where you're an expert, really, Caroline. So I hope I've kind of given an overview of how intrinsically this is linked, the past, the pattern that's repeating itself and accelerating into our future, and the blindness that we have because we're still told this story that colonization is over, that growth is the only model. But in recognizing that, and in being able to stand outside of the tribalism in a way that's affected us and has made us treat each other that way, we can take a look. As you say, the window of opportunity is shrinking to be able to do that. But perhaps that might give us the impetus to take that step and see ourselves as a human family that can rewrite another future for itself if we can break the patterns of this past. So I think there's really nobody better to talk to about about how that might happen than you, really, Caroline. So I'd like to ask you a couple of questions now, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So you're the director and founder of the Institute for Small Islands. You're an international lawyer with a specialism in post-colonial relations, indigenous rights, and in climate and environmental justice. So can you give us an overview of your work and its purpose? And how can this be effective in helping us recognize the imprint of colonization in our worldview and in our personal and organizational practices today? That's a big chunk, but if you could take that on, I'd be very happy.
It's a big chunk and it's a big social question. I'm going to take it down to the intensely personal to answer the purpose, because I came across something the other day that made me absolutely cry. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to look for it right here. And I sent it to my PI. I sent it to the shaman of the First Peoples. And I had a little wobble, you know, it was so powerful. So I'm going to just start to read it. I'm not going to read it all, but, you know, and we're talking about the Inyeri, the Saladoid, were the ancient agro-ceramic people from which the Ayeri culture descended. It is through their distinct styles of ceramics and blah, 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 Ayeri people from their origins in the Amazon up to the present times. And then they're talking about from the Saladero, Venezuela, believed to be the place where the Saladoid people first moved into the Lesser Antilles. And the Saladoid ceramic and agricultural practices laid the foundations for the Kalinago culture. And then they're talking about, this is why I'm excited. So I am part Kalinago by way of St. Kitts. And I'm also First Peoples of Trinidad. And I'm a couple of other things. And for me, this is so exciting because it's talking about the Kalinya. And, you know, I just met the Kalinya from Suriname. So this is exciting for me because I grew up reading in my history books about the Caribs and the Arawaks, and Columbus met the Arawaks, and they were the scary Caribs, the cannibal Caribs, and they chomped their way up, you know, through the Caribbean, chomping after the Arawaks because they were cannibals, and that's where the word came from. So those are my ancestors. And I'm like, wait, hold on. You know, this is awfully reductive. I remember thinking very vividly as a young teenager, very young teenager. And that was, you know, like that was in our form one. So that would have been like, you know, 12, 13. And so, you know, I remember thinking, hold on, we're not genocided. I remember thinking that and thinking, wait, granny is part Carib. Like, how is that possible? And then, you know, even now, the story is not still told. And for me, that's new. And for me, talking about seeing, you know, what LIDAR and archaeologists are bringing up in the Orinoco Delta, these are my people. That's my people there. That made me cry. That made me cry. That made me do ugly tears crying. And I'm going to read to you what I sent to this person. I said, "You made me cry ugly tears with your post. Never had the deepest core of me felt so seen by someone giving me my own history about my own people in such intense and vivid detail. It felt like water on a hot day. It felt like coming home. I didn't realize I felt so much like a grandmother and grandfatherless child until this very moment. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Please keep sharing more. May I quote you, blah, blah, blah." And, aww. You know, that's why I do this. That is my purpose. My purpose is to bring life back to that moment, to bring those treaties back to life, to bring those things that were hidden under the carpet some light of day. And there are a lot of people doing a lot of work on reclaiming that history. And yeah, I just kind of want to stick an oar in, basically, and help. So, you know, taking it from the intensely personal to to the more general, what the overview of our work. What we do, I would say we've been in operation since 2017. We have one of the first, if not the first, pro bono legal advice centers that cater almost exclusively to indigenous peoples and small islands. Well, it does cater exclusively to indigenous peoples and small islands in the Caribbean. We are working through diplomacy. So we take, or we support, or we help fund, or we go to UN negotiations or conferences. So the UNFCCC, the climate negotiation, UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So I've been going to that since 2011. I was invited to go in 2009, but I was doing the bar, so I wasn't able to. But I just kind of took all of those. I've been continuing that with Legal Response International, and then with the government of Trinidad and Tobago, and, well, obviously through the institutes. And so that's been one of them. But then with our American United Maroon Indigenous Peoples, one of our clients is a very amazing woman. I keep on telling her, if she was a Swedish man, she would have a Nobel Peace Prize. She is an Afro-Indigenous woman who is reforesting the Northern Range. She's protecting it from firefighters. She's trying to push through forest fire legislation. She's also uniting Maroon. She's one of the women, one of the grandmother leaders, uniting Maroons, Afro-Indigenous women and peoples across the Caribbean, Greater Caribbean and North America, and even into Brazil region. So, I mean, she's incredible. She's absolutely incredible. So through her, we've been supporting her. We're on the legal and academic team, and we support her with a host of other academics, you know, down to as basic as, let's set up and register United Maroon Indigenous Peoples and get the website going and the email going. As basic as that, you know, it's kind of almost a boutique. Mm. What you need for them to go to these conferences, to help write the speeches, to help get the funding, to et cetera. We also do litigation. So we're working with the Garifuna right now on protection of the ocean heritage and their cultural heritage. I don't want to give too much because we've not, you know, filed anything. So we're working with the Garifuna. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that within the courts. And we are also looking externally at external international regional courts. But enough of that. We're also working with some Australian clients so it's not only in the Greater Caribbean that, you know, there is a sovereign nation who wants to treaty with Commonwealth of Australia. They've never done so in the past. There's someone who wants to do something about rights of nature. Oh gosh, I can't talk too much, you know, but it's really exciting, really interesting areas of law. And then we also do negotiations. So like, for example, if a university wants to do a project, we've unfortunately had to, you know, stand up and say, well, what's in it for them? Because you're not paying them. They're not researching. A lot of
people
stand up and say, they're not subjects. They're not objects. They're subjects,
yeah,
you know?
Subject. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely fascinating work, Caroline, and with the potential to bring so much hope back as well, because you're probably aware of Dr. Leila June, the First Nations artist and scholar. She's got a beautiful short video of how do humans regenerate Earth, and she invites us to think of ourselves as an anchor ecosystem species, which feels like a real stretch at first, but in actual fact it's a heritage, it's a memory. The people that you're talking about, your own people, have never really stepped out of that worldview. So you know, this way is actually we've got such a huge opportunity to learn from, you know, to see ourselves in this different way as givers of life, as people who support Earth to be more beautiful, to flourish, as opposed to taking everything and being part of, you know, of its demise, the planet's demise, which is ultimately our own. So how can a company, because you're working with these fantastic communities around the globe, how does this translate to companies? How can a company engage with understanding environmental justice and supporting more diverse voices in the workplace to be part of creating this more regenerative future? You know, what can we learn from this Indigenous knowledge? How can we use it to guide us in the decisions that we make as organisations, or as we try to build, do we need to build a completely new system, or can organisations start from where they are?
But what answer do you want? Do you want my uplifting answer? Do you want my honest answer?
Well, let's have both. I mean, let's try to, if you can, yeah, give them in a balanced way, because yeah, it is, you know, we need to be realistic about what we're facing here. Yeah,
my honest answer is I do not think companies can understand where Indigenous peoples are coming from, because there are two. Now, when my Jamaican accent slightly comes out a little bit, you understand I'm being serious, and it's a terrible one too. Right. There are, you can't see if this is a podcast, but I'm going to do some demonstrations here. Imagine a Venn diagram and they're kind of bumping up against each other. And they're not allowing each other in. And there's no intersecting in that Venn diagram. That's what you have when you have Indigenous peoples encountering companies. Because these are two worldviews, two world systems, the pluriverse, abutting each other in that moment. Because Indigenous peoples live in a cashless society. They walk out of their house, which is almost very open air, and they go into their forest garden and they go into their pharmacy and they go and deal with their crops. And that's what they live on. They might trade with their families and friends. They might have markets. They might, you know, get some cash to do things that they need to interact with the rest of society. But, you know, just yesterday, not yesterday, a couple of days ago, I was with the PI, the shaman for the First Peoples. And he said, oh, look, my pepper harvest is coming. It's like a vine on the tree that we're passing, you know, on the side of a ravine, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, hanging on for my dear life and looking down, these they're bending down picking up pepper. I'm like, well, this is new. You know. So this is what I'm saying. It's entirely different. And we need to understand what forest gardens are. We're talking about these forest gardens. That's what forest gardens are. Forest gardens are, you plant as you go along, you leave it. You leave it to flower, you leave it to bloom, you leave it for somebody else, and you go on and you make more. It's a completely different way of living. So when you come into a community and you treat with one group of the community and they say no, when you find somebody and you find somebody and you find somebody to say yes and sign off, you're not talking to the right person.
Yeah.
You need to be talking to the elders. If you find somebody who's like very quick to be like, yes, give me the money, the community is so happy, where do I sign? There's a problem. So you need to understand moving into another sovereign nation's territory, whether they're acknowledged or unacknowledged. And once you begin to understand that you're in another, like if you step onto the Vatican, you're not anymore. If you step onto an, you're not in Washington anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
So this is how we need to start to understand. And this is what they refuse to understand. So right now we're working with leaders across parts of Latin America, certain countries. I don't want to say which ones. No, I can say which ones. It's like Colombia, Ecuador, that kind of thing. It's not a big deal. I tend to be just very secretive about my work just in general. And we're working on biodiversity markets and carbon markets. And so this is really, really important stuff that I'm talking about. It's not airy-fairy. It's not like, you know, I've sat in panel discussions with people where we've all had to have a moment because somebody just broke down on stage because he's talking about, you know, I wrote an article about it. You know, there's no food left in the tundra. There's no fish left in the river. There are no animals. Everything is polluted. The children leave, or if they stay, they have to be maids. And that's when the sexual exploitation starts. And that's when he started to cry. He's a 60-year-old man sitting down and just crying on stage because he's looking at the decimation of the culture that was, you know, took so much to build back. You know, so if you want to see what first contact was, it's happening now. If you want to happen when Columbus was here, when Pizarro was here, when Cortez was here, it is happening now. That those are people to understand.
Yeah, I can see that, Caroline. I mean, in a way, you know, thank you very much for giving such an honest and realistic answer. I mean, I do find there is something uplifting in there, really, because it does now enable us to see that there is possible to hold a very different view of how we organize our economies, how we organize our trading systems, how we organize our societies that are regenerative. The bridge, how we get that into, you know, I've talked about, you know, I asked you the question, how can companies engage with this? I can see that you're looking at two hugely different world views, but simply knowing, as it was for you, you know, when you're talking about the artifacts, the heritage that were coming out of the river, simply knowing that that exists is a hugely powerful thing, because I think so many of us are caught up in the view that there is only this one system, and many of us know that it's an entirely destructive system, that the creating endless growth out of finite resources is just not possible. The maths alone is not possible, let alone what happens, you know, in the inequality in society. So while it's a sobering answer, there is some hope in there for us that there are other systems, other ways of being here on Earth that we can learn from, and that we can remodel. We can build these new models that take us to safety, as opposed to being stuck in an old one, which is fueling our demise. So, Caroline, we're drawing to the close of our podcast. I've got time for one more question for you, Caroline. Have you got just something that you'd, no, please do add.
Answer for saying how can they engage responsibly? UN UNDRIP Treaty, UN Treaty Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Read that. FPIC, Free Prior Informed Consent. Read that. That's my positive answer.
Okay, that sounds good. It's always good to keep learning. Yeah, I'll just put those links somewhere in the podcast so that they're available for people to refer to too. So you're doing this incredible pioneering work to help us as a human family, not only understand our legacy of the past, but identifying this, you know, where the solutions lie for us to live in partnership with the planet that supports us. It might not, you know, not everybody's not going with me. We talked about forest gardens. I'm sure that there's collaborations that can be, it's the overall principle of regenerative living with planet Earth. And you're creating frameworks to bring critical, yet for so long marginalized or completely excluded voices into the conversations that determine our future here on Earth. Because yes, it is absolutely shocking that that the voices remain so much from this, you know, the reflecting colonization, this dominant global North voices, and you've got this whole section of the human family that hold all this wisdom and this knowledge. They're excluded. You're bringing these people in to the conversation. I mean, I can only think that this is something that that any progressive leader would want to learn from. So how are you planning to get this work into the wider world? And, you know, it's critical, actually, that we learn from this. As you said earlier, the window is shrinking, that unless we can find different worldviews, different ways of understanding how to be here, you know, we are in a desperate situation. So how are you planning to get this into the wider world, and how can we be part of supporting you to do that?
Well, you know, it's interesting you ask. There are two things that I've been thinking of, and one is a platform for Indigenous voices to be heard on matters that are important to us. And they exist already. But I mean, for the developing, and people hate that term, but, you know, developing countries. Countries that have been, you know, the global majority, that but they've been shut out of the global trade, and they are poorer. So it's harder, you know, if you are in a, because, you know, I have a problem with global majority and global minority, because they hide the truth of the fact that some countries are wealthy and some countries are poorer. Anyway, in a poorer country, you don't have access. So Indigenous peoples are less connected and more discriminated against and less listened to. So right now, Indigenous peoples in the global North are being a little bit more listened to. And due to interpretation, you know, problems and reach and whatnot, I feel like Indigenous peoples in the global South are being kind of tokenized, and it pisses me off in a real way,
yeah.
So it's kind of like, no, we need our own table where you have to come. You know, like, being at the first, at the climate change conference, it's very distasteful to me to see that Indigenous peoples are left out and not at the table, when nations that are younger than some of these sovereign nations that have been around for millennia, and I feel like I say this every time, are, you know, they're excluded from the table. And I'm like, it impacts them the most, and they've contributed the absolute least, less than small islands. You know, small islands, at least some form of emission, they have had zero. You know, and for me, that's just heartbreaking. And the loss of this culture is so, I mean, these are stories tracking back into time that we don't know. There's science that we, there's botany that we don't know. There's medicine that we don't know, you know. So that's one. And then we are looking at developing communities. How can you be part of what we do? Support, fund. We need funding. So we're working on tourism and supporting tourism to get money into the pockets of Indigenous peoples, literally. To how can we support their shamanic practices? How can they, you know, it's like going to the doctor. How can we incorporate that? How can we make that more normal and less ostracized and less scary? You know, because these are people who were called witches, literally. They're you know, marginalizes witches. How can we make that, you know, and I'm loath to put these ideas onto the public space. Because there's always some idiot who goes and jumps and does it. And I'm like, oh boy, you're not doing it properly. It's not about you, it's about them. You go to them, you go to them what they want. You go to the proper person. You don't just jump in and drop in. They're not playthings, they're not objects of fascination, right? So that's really, really important. And then, so what we're trying to do is we're trying to create models that incorporate and respect their perspective. And so if you guys are interested in doing it, from an Indigenous-led point of view, please definitely get in touch and we can talk about extrapolating those models out. And if we want to work on, you know, that platform where we're amplifying their voice and their voice alone and nobody else's, yeah, but talk to us. If you want to support litigation and you're a lawyer and you have experience on this, please, yeah, come in. We're training young lawyers, training young Indigenous lawyers and reporters and interpreters. So we're trying to, you know, it's exhausting and time consuming trying to get funding for climate justice and Indigenous rights in the Caribbean, because that's just, those are Venn diagrams that don't match up, you know, again. So please, yeah, that's what we need, basically. We need someone to amplify what we're doing and we need someone to help fund what we're doing. And I'm not even ashamed to say that. It's so funny that in our own region, we don't even know that they're Indigenous peoples. Full stop.
Yeah, Caroline, you know, it's kind of really heart-wrenching to hear you speak. And I know that's a legacy, again, of colonization, that these people have been so erased, so marginalized, so, you know, the history of the people is not known, the voice is not known, is not heard. And yet the power in that knowledge, in those communities, in those systems is immense. And it's the regenerative power that we need to take us forward now. Caroline, you've got one more thing to say. Please go ahead.
How can you also help? How can you not? How can you not help? How can you help? Don't be the person who co-opts Indigenous voices and then uses your voice to get famous or get money or get massive benefits when they don't. That's wrong. Yeah. That is the... And don't decide that you're some sort of guru now that you've been spending time with Indigenous peoples. They're the guru, all right? Yeah. They are, not you. So if you want to help, be humble. Be really, really humble, because they are the ones who can show you a lot more than you can show them. Seriously. Like, tuck that ego away.
I can't think of a better... clarion message to all of us, really, than what you've just said there, Caroline. It's been such a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you so much for all the incredible work that you're doing, pioneering, frontline, essential work, and for sharing, taking the time to share that with us today. It has huge power, and I hope that's resonated with everybody who's listening. Thank you.
Oh gosh, thank you. Thank you so much for this space and the spotlight and this platform to share what we're doing. I'm really quite excited about it. It's my little baby. We just moved into a new office. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Awakenings podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please do share the podcast, and you can visit my website. It's www.cindyford.com. I'd like to thank everybody who's been part of this, our wonderful systems thinkers who have joined us, and I'd really like a special thanks to go to Foundation Nova Diem, who've made this podcast possible. It's been such a pleasure to share this time with you. Thank you so much for listening.